From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Hayward, California.
Nopa.
Kind of lower Russian Hill.
I live across from El Metate in San Francisco.
Coming up, we explore the advent of black television programming and what it meant for TV studios.
Trying to get studio technicians to understand what kind of coloring the light gel should be. Because if you're going to have darker skinned people, you don't want to use a lot of green.
Then we visit a dance company that spent 40 years showcasing the culture of the African diaspora.
What you see in the arts is what is mainstream, and we're not mainstream.
And we'll tell you the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
Nobody will forget this laugh after they hear it. They'll remember that forever, to take that with them.
And we'll take you with us on a cultural history ride today on Cross Currents. When you turn on your television set today, you're bombarded with all kinds of shows, sitcoms, reality shows, news, sports, political debates, and you probably see a lot of different kinds of people. Today, TV is culturally diverse, but it wasn't always so. African Americans didn't really have a strong television presence until, well, what's the first black TV show you remember?
Well, we're moving on.
What made all those shows possible was a movement that started in the late 1960s. After the assassination of Martin Luther King, black people wanted a voice and were producing shows on public television to express their political views and concerns of the time. A new book, Black Power TV, by Devorah Heitner, chronicles the birth of these programs, what they were meant to do, and what they indeed turned out to be. Devorah joined me in studio along with San Francisco-based author Jewel Gomez, who worked on the 1960s program Say Brother. Jewel Gomez, tell me about your beginnings with Say Brother.
When I arrived for the first day of work, and the director was black, the producer was black, other staff members were all African American, I realized it was something revolutionary happening, because you never saw black people on television unless they were doing reruns of Amos and Andy.
Did you feel that they were modeled after mainstream shows or quote-unquote white shows, or were you starting something new and fresh, and was that a challenge?
Everything was kind of new. Everything from trying to get studio technicians to understand what kind of coloring the light gel should be. Because if you're going to have darker skinned people, you don't want to use a lot of green. And what kind of backdrops people should have, because the clothes are going to be different. You know, regularly in television, you're told, don't wear any patterns. Don't wear white, don't wear any patterns. But if you're going to have African-American artists and political people coming on TV, they're going to be wearing patterns. They're going to be wearing dashikis. They're going to be wearing all of the bright colors that people tend to stay away from.
And Stan Lathan also, who worked on both Say Brother and then Black Journal and Soul as well, he talked about the politics of using close-ups. I quote him in the book, and he said that a white cinematographer said, well, people won't be able to look at black faces in close-up because they'll find it grotesque. And he started to shoot, he said, after that, as many close-ups of black faces as possible and inserted them into these shows. And so there was a real intentional aesthetic disruption.
But also in terms of format, one of the things that became really clear is that African Americans wanted to have a news show, but they also connected their news with their culture. They did not separate information about what was going on with Mandela in South Africa from listening to the stylistics sing. They really saw the poetry of Langston Hughes as significant to their everyday lives. as knowing what was going on with the neighborhood housing programs.
So let's hear a clip from Say Brother. The program featured interviews on everything from politics to education, health, sports, and war. Here's boxer Muhammad Ali on the show in 1969.
Black people really don't have nothing to fight for. We go to Vietnam, we come back, I saw a brother coming to the airport with no arms and one leg cut off. Couldn't find nobody to push him to a taxi cab. Come back home and we fight for our own freedom, we get our heads beat up. And I just don't think I should go 10,000 miles from here and shoot some black people that never caught me, never lynched me, never put dogs on me, never raped my mama, enslaved me and deprived me of freedom, justice, equality, and he's black too. I just can't shoot him.
That's boxer Muhammad Ali on the program Say Brother from 1969, making a pretty strong anti-war statement. Jewel Gomez, how much of the content of black TV was, do you think, you know, politically focused?
I have to say one thing. I feel incredibly proud. I was the one who talked Muhammad Ali into coming onto our show. I dialed his hotel room and got him on the phone.
Oh, tell me about that.
That was such a shock. I called his hotel. He picked up the phone and tried to pretend he wasn't him. But he has such a distinguished voice. I mean, of course it was him. So I just went along with it and I described the show. I said, I can send you material. He said, okay, call me back. I hung up. In about an hour, I called him back. He said, what time? And he showed up at the studio. His people drove him to the studio. And I didn't believe he was going to actually show up. And there he was. I went flying from the studio when they called me from the front desk to say he was there. I flew down the hallway, slammed open the door, and hit him with the doorknob, which probably reached maybe to his belt buckle. He was so big. And I was so apologetic. You couldn't, I was like, what can you say? And he was like a doll. He was a doll. He was so thoughtful and kind and thrilled. And he wanted to meet everybody. And he wanted to meet the black producers and staff. He was so thrilled. It was pretty amazing. And then he gave that great interview, you know, that was so perfect. Really giving us real reasons for African Americans to be suspicious about war. And I think in reality, everything we did was about politics. Because we were visible on the airwaves doing anything, it was going to be political. Whether we were, you know, interviewing any black nationalist activist, we did a wonderful interview with the young musicians who survived the plane crash which killed Otis Redding. And they were still in post-traumatic stress. But they wanted to be able to talk about Otis because they understood how quickly he could be forgotten. And that was very political. And they were there, they came to talk because they did not want a great artist to disappear.
And our arts and music are a massive part of the African American experience, and the black TV shows reflected that. Here are the impressions playing on a live special edition of Say Brother from March 1969.
Everybody, woo, you don't do no nothing. We're a winner, baby. Come on, everyone, why not give us just a little bit of a soul clap? You know how to give that little soul clap? Just like that. All right. Now everybody say, hey.
So, and it wasn't just playing the music, but discussions of the history of the music, as we hear on this June 1969 episode of Say Brother, hosted by Jim Spruill.
There is great talent in the black community. We know this because white people are constantly stealing everything we have and packaging it and calling it whiteness. Witness the Beatles, you know, witness Cream. This is all black music. It's all black music. If we had a package going in this country where all black artists belong to black organizations, the only way white people would get to see their black people whom they love so much in music and in dance and in art is through us.
There were so few images of African Americans on television, and they were so limited. Julia and I Spy, you know, these shows that just denied American apartheid and pretended that it didn't exist. And so to see Roxbury and Bedford-Stuyvesant, to see communities that were never represented, for people to turn on the opening of Say Brother and see their neighborhood, see those images, that was very, very powerful.
Devorah Heitner is author of Black Power TV, and Jewel Gomez is a San Francisco-based author and former producer of Say Brother. You'll find information about that show and the book at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba.
Because the revolution will not be televised.
As we just heard, the Black Power movement had an artistic branch known as the Black Arts Movement, which had its heyday in the late 60s and early 70s. The term Black Arts was coined by the poet Amiri Baraka. He argued for cultural sovereignty through art making that refused to assimilate to mainstream white norms.
We want a black poem and a black world. Let the world be a black poem.
The Bay Area was a hub for artists involved with the Black Arts Movement, with Marcus Books opening in 1960, Black Arts West Theater Company in the Fillmore in San Francisco, and Oakland's Dimensions Dance Theater, which this year celebrates 40 years of presenting African and African-derived dance. KALW's Jen Sheehan has more.
The pulse of drums spills out onto the street from an upper window of the Malanga Cascalord Center for the Arts, a big Art Deco building in the Lakeside District of Oakland. Inside that third-story studio, a battery of eight drummers is lined up against one wall of the room, vibrating the air with their music. 12 dancers, men and women all dressed in black rehearsal clothes, move with fierce and graceful undulations through the space. They dance all together, totally synchronized, then suddenly break out into individual gestures, hip shakes, stepping and stomping. This is Dimensions Dance Theater, one of the oldest African-American dance companies in the country. They had their first full season in 1973. Most dance companies don't stay in business that long. Dance is not a highly funded art form. Deborah Vaughn, artistic director of Dimensions, says that when she looks back at the history of the company, the beginning looks a lot like today.
As in, started with struggle, and the struggle goes on. It's a challenge. But one of the things that I guess keeps you motivated is like the work itself.
That work is exploring and presenting African and African-derived dance. Vaughn has been doing it since she was a young girl growing up in Oakland. When she was 12, a friend told her about Ruth Beckford's modern and Afro-Haitian dance classes run through the city's Parks and Rec Department.
And I found that it was something that I loved doing. The dancing, the movement, the history, the theater.
Vaughn went on to study modern, ballet, West African, South African, and Central African dance forms. She went to Mills College for a graduate degree in dance in the early 70s, pretty much at the height of the Black Arts Movement. At that time, artists all over the country were celebrating blackness, digging into African American history and culture, and exploring the roots of that culture from Africa itself. Here's the poet Nikki Giovanni from an album she did in 1971 with the New York Community Choir.
I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built the Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I am bad. I am so hip. Even my errors are correct.
At Mills, Deborah Vaughn and fellow graduate student Ellender Barnes were studying the roots of African-American dance forms, and they wanted to use that material in their thesis concert. They choreographed dances using modern, jazz, and Haitian forms and mixed them with spoken word.
What we were trying to do in that concert is just show the diversity of, like, dance that was African-based.
The concert was so successful that people approached them later to ask when the next show would be. So Vaughn and Barnes, along with their fellow dance grad student Shirley Brown, founded Dimensions Dance Theater. They also started a school to train dancers for the company. But money was tight and funding was scarce, so Vaughn says once they left Mills, they danced wherever they could.
Hither and yon. We had been in several churches.
And other locations not necessarily made for dance. From the beginning, Dimensions focused on a range of styles, Haitian, modern, jazz, and even ballet. This was pretty unusual, and still is today.
I think that what happens with the arts is a microcosm of the macrocosm. And so what you see in the arts is, like, you know, probably what is mainstream, and, like, you know, we're not mainstream.
Since then, Dimensions has premiered over 50 evening-length dance works. That's a lot for a company its size. Many of these pieces were choreographed and directed by Vaughn herself, but the company has also collaborated with many other artists. They ranged from early pieces like My People, set to the poetry of Langston Hughes, to Common Ground, a collaboration with the Lily Kai Chinese Dance Company that brought African and Chinese dance forms together. Vaughn has collaborated with master musicians like South African horn legend Hugh Masekela, percussionist John Santos, and the late Bay Area jazz trumpeter Khalil Shahid. They've also been running free and low-cost youth programs for 20 years and a junior company that has performed throughout the U.S. Through it all, Vaughn says Dimensions has stayed true to its original mission.
The company came together to preserve and perpetuate African and African-derived dance forms. And so to that end, I think that, you know, we are following, you know, our mission in bringing those things to stage.
That commitment is shown in the piece that will premiere at Dimension's 40th anniversary celebration. It's called Rhythms of Life, Down the Congo Line. The choreography highlights the way that original dances from the Congo have traveled around the world, in this case to Brazil, Cuba, and New Orleans.
What I wanted to do was to bring those dances to the stage to show their connection, but what I also wanted to do was to bring communities together.
Vaughn says that even though many kinds of cultural dance are practiced in the Bay Area, true cross-collaboration is not that common. So she commissioned four different choreographers to make the different sections of the piece. Exuberant and joyous Congolese dance by Hervé Makaya. The intense Afro-Cuban Palo to connect to ancestors by José Cheo Rojas. Celebratory New Orleans Second Line by Latanya Tigner. And fierce Brazilian Maculele, danced with sticks, by Isaura Oliveira. Oliveira says this kind of collaborative performance is unusual for her. But it also seems like a natural outgrowth of teaching at the Malonga Center, where Dimensions is based, and where many styles of dance are taught.
We walk through the halls and see each other's class, and then we visit each other. We go depth, oh, this movement, we have this movement on the Makulele. Oh, we have this kind of the shins and look like this. So it is around and surround and among us, you know, alive.
Tonight we are here to celebrate, to use our bodies in service of our people, because dance still means we who believe in the push and pull of the universe. Dance.
In the steamy rehearsal studio, Oakland poet Marvin White recites an incantation as the dancers slowly move into place for the next section.
Dance still means we who are celebrating so children can see us in an act of love. Death is not the hand.
Standing off to one side, Deborah Vaughn watches as her dancers stomp, leap, and glide across the floor. And from the rapt attention on her face, it's clear that 40 years has not dimmed her enthusiasm for this.
When it comes to the African diaspora, I mean, it could just go on forever, you know?
In Oakland, I'm Jen Sheehan for Cross Currents.
Dimensions Dance Theater's 40th anniversary performance is this Saturday at 8 p.m. at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. For more information, go to our website, klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound. We asked you to tell us what that was and where we recorded it. KALW's Julie Kane brings you the answer.
My name is Dan Zielinski. We are at Pier 45 in San Francisco on the end of Taylor Street on the Embarcadero, inside of Pier 45. It is called Musée Mécanique.
Stand still so I can hit you.
This is a collection that my dad started back in 1933 of coin-operated antique mechanical musical instruments, arcade machines, fortune tellers, photo booths, strength testers, love testers, games of chance and skill, just turn of the century fun.
And what do you do here?
What do I do here? I'm the guy. What do I do? I do whatever it takes to keep my machines and customers happy.
And how do you get around this place?
I patrol all day on roller skates. I started out on a skateboard out at the Cliff House. I started patrolling back and forth, but somebody stole my skateboard. So I figured, well, they can't steal roller skates out from under me. So I've been skating ever since.
So tell me about some of the most iconic sounds. And I'm thinking in particular about a lady at the entrance.
Ah, laughing sound. She's a 6 foot tall, carrot-topped, curly-haired mechanical doll. She was built in Philadelphia by the Philadelphia Toboggan Company. As far as I know, they made over 500 of them and sold them all over the country, if not around the world. We have one of two that used to be at Playland at the beach, because that machine would run. Laughing Sal would run 7 days a week, every day of the year, for about 16 hours a day. So if one broke, you know, instead of having downtime, they just swap one out. And so she was always going. So if you lived in the neighborhood, Laughing Sal was going every day of your life. Christmas, every day. Nobody will forget this laugh after they hear it. They'll remember that forever. They take that with them.
Okay, so a lot of you got this week's sound right.
I'm calling to identify the sound.
The audio current thing, the soundtrack thing?
This is Saturday, right after Car Talk, and I heard that laughing.
I think that's Laughing Sal.
Big Sally. Laughing Sal. Is that her name? And I say that it was the fat lady recorded at the Musée Mécanique.
That robot scared my mother to death when she was a small child.
Perhaps I'll get a return call letting me know how right I was and that I've won $1 million. So look forward to hearing the good news.
My name is Cora Schimitz, and my mom's name is Meredith Eldred. We wanted to verify that the sound that we heard on the radio was from Laughing Sal at Musée Mécanique at Pier 39. What? Number is it, Mom? Fisherman's Wharf. Thank you.
Wow. Well, we love hearing from you, so keep those coming. But this week's lucky winner is Cora Schimitz. Congratulations, Cora. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For everyone else, we'll have a new mystery sound next week. Here's a sneak peek. stay tuned to KALW to hear it again, or check out Audiograph on our website, kalw.org. And that's the end of today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Christina Loring, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Ryan Miller, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Todd Whitney. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our senior producer. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. This is the music of The Brothers Comatose, one of many bands from around the Bay and beyond who'll be at Golden Gate Park on Sunday as a part of this year's extensive and free Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival. For more information, go to kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.